From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump became the first sitting president to attend the annual March for Life rally in Washington today.
We're here for a very simple reason: to defend the right of every child, born and unborn, to fulfill their God-given potential.
As the president addressed the anti-abortion rights gathering on the National Mall, Democrats were just a few blocks away on Capitol Hill getting ready to make their final pitch in the Senate impeachment trial. Joining us now is Claudia Grisales. She is congressional reporter for NPR. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
And some context here. President Trump, back in 1999, called himself a very pro-choice. During the 2016 campaign, he said his views had changed, and he's essentially been an ally to groups opposing abortion ever since. What do you make of his attendance at this rally today?
So this appearance, along with other appearances the president has made in recent weeks and months, touch on an argument that his ally here on Capitol Hill has made, Lindsey Graham, that the president should continue to act like a president, not focus on impeachment. So he urged President Trump to follow the President Clinton model during the impeachment process during his time and focus on policy, focus on being there at rallies or making statements on policy. So I think this appearance at this rally today and other efforts are all part of this greater campaign to take the attention towards the job and the work of being president, rather than focusing on impeachment.
Is it fair to say, though, that this is actually something of a campaign rally as well? Because the president's going to need the support of white evangelical voters in November.
I think some folks would argue that's what this visit may be about. But at the same time, he has framed it in a way that this is just about him making an appearance on an issue that is important to him as president. So I could see it being argued both ways.
Okay. As I said, just a few blocks away, Democratic House managers wrapping up their case today for removing the president from office. And let's listen to a little bit of what we heard this week. Here's the lead Democrat House manager, Adam Schiff.
Ultimately, the question for you is whether the president's undisputed actions require the removal of the 45th president of the United States from office because he abused his office and the public trust by using his power for personal gain, by seeking illicit foreign assistance in his reelection and covering it up.
So we are almost through the first week of this impeachment trial. Claudia, do you think any minds have been changed, either in the Senate or in the public at large?
I think at least in the Senate, if any minds have been changed, they're not telling us because we're not hearing a lot about that. We're hearing just new variations of the arguments for or against the removal of the president. For when it comes to the Democrats, they talk about the waves of evidence and the impressive presentations they're seeing from House managers. But when we talk to Republicans, a lot of them are saying we're hearing repetitive statements. We're seeing videos over and over again, and we still don't think there is a case there. Mm-hmm. So we're not hearing a changing of minds. As far as the general public, it's possible that some minds have been changed. They've repackaged the way they are telling the story of impeachment. They're doing it chronologically. They're defending it article by article, and they're doing it in what is a more condensed timeline, 24 hours versus the weeks, the months of hearings and closed-door testimony.
Well, we are at least likely to get a change in tone tomorrow when the president's defense team starts its argument. It's going to be on a Saturday, and this is something that the president is not very happy about. He said on Twitter today that Saturday is Death Valley in TV. But how much actually are we going to hear from his defenders tomorrow? Will it be very much?
So it's pretty interesting. The president tweeted about his concerns about it airing on a Saturday. And we have heard some members, some senators, Republican members, saying that they hope for it to be a shorter day. So if it is indeed a shorter day, I just heard one senator say that it could be a 9 a.m. to noonday. It'll be the shortest so far of the week. So it will be a quick glimpse into the president's legal team presenting his defense. They say it's going going to be robust. They say they're going to be attacking the House manager's case one by one, and they're going to be expeditious about it. So those are some of the things I'll be looking for tomorrow.
Senate leader Mitch McConnell now says that the trial will start at 10 tomorrow. It'll run for several hours. So we will see. And quickly, very quickly, Claudia, likelihood of witnesses later on?
So the likelihood of witnesses, perhaps before this trial started, it seemed like the chances for witnesses were higher. We were hearing from these three more moderate Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Mitt Romney of Utah, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. They were leaning towards maybe calling witnesses. And there was a fourth member. They need a fourth Republican member, so the Democrats do, to call witnesses. And that was Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. But he has been very tight-lipped and hasn't given any signal that he's going to be for this plan to call witnesses.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, while the impeachment trial played out in Congress this week, President Trump made some news on another topic. He gave an interview to CNBC's Joe Kernan in Davos, Switzerland on Wednesday. Kernan asked Trump whether he would ever try to cut social programs, which are sometimes called entitlements.
The growth is going to be incredible. And at the right time, we will take a look at that. You know, that's actually the easiest of all things, if you look. Because it's such
a big
percentage.
You're willing to do some of the things that you said you wouldn't do in the past, though, in terms of Medicare.
Well, we're going to look. We also have assets that we never had. I mean, we never had growth like this.
Well, criticism of that statement came fast, and President Trump responded in a tweet, "Democrats are going to destroy your Social Security. I have totally left it alone, as promised, and we'll save it." We're joined by NPR business correspondent Jim Zaroli. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the question again is, as it is so many times with President Trump, should we take the statement he made in the interview seriously or the tweet?
Yeah, it's hard to say what he meant. The initial remarks seemed to be something that he sort of said off the cuff, but it was pretty vague. He said it's something that we will eventually be on our plates. And he was talking about entitlement reform, which is usually taken to mean Medicare and Social Security. He said it'll be toward the end of the year. What is true, what is clear is that the budget deficit has grown under President Trump's watch, and that's unusual in good economic times. And he would like to address that. And entitlement reform is something Republicans, of course, have talked about for years. Lots of people would like to see that happen. Now, are they going to do that in an election year? That seems pretty unlikely.
Well, you say they've talked about it. What have they actually done in terms of proposing cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, federal housing subsidies, et cetera?
Well, it's something the president has talked about before. He signed an executive order last year ordering the government to look into raising reimbursement rates in a way that would raise costs for recipients, for seniors. He was quoted last summer as saying it's something he would want to look into in his second term. Many Republicans have been pressing him to do this. But the problem is that the president has also repeatedly said he would not cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and those are the big items in the budget. I mean, you cannot reduce the deficit without cutting these programs or raising taxes, and it's pretty clear he's not going to do the latter.
What about the argument that he made? He said, we also have assets that we've never had. We have never had growth like this. He's often talked about the strength of the economy under his presidency. But what about that argument that if the economy is strong, then that's the time to make cuts to some of these safety net programs?
Yeah, he seemed to be saying that because the economy is doing well, we have a lot of assets, I think is what he said. So this would be a good time to cut entitlements. And I would say two things. First, you know, the job market is very tight. The unemployment rate is low. But the U.S. economy isn't really growing much faster than it has been for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. And even if it were, there are big questions about what that should mean for entitlement spending. I mean, you can assume that when the economy is doing well, the government needs to spend less on programs like food stamps, for instance. You can also say, you know, when the economy is doing well, then people's 401ks, their retirement savings go up. But Medicare costs are not falling. They are rising regardless of what the economy is doing. And so are Social Security costs. And those are programs that a large swath of people in the country depend on primarily, including a lot of the people that voted for President Trump.
So, Jim, even if there is not really a political appetite right now to make any cuts. According to the latest estimates, taxpayers may not be able to keep paying for Social Security under the current budget as soon as this year. There are some bills in Congress to try to address this. But what is actually needed to keep Social Security and Medicare afloat?
Yeah, you know, there's always talk about cuts in Social Security and Medicare. A lot of people would like to see it happen. But I just need to say again, I mean, it would be political suicide for the Republicans to take this up in an election year, and they know that. I mean, don't forget, most people over 65 voted for President Trump. And a lot of people will say, you know, this is especially difficult to do right after you've passed a big tax cut that's widely viewed as having benefited corporations and wealthy Americans, as Republicans did in 2017.
So a difficult task, and we will watch to see if that ever comes up again or if if that tweet is the last word about it for now. NPR business correspondent Jim Zaroli, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Gene.
What's good?
You know, we probably shouldn't be friends.
Why are you trying to hurt my feelings?
I mean, statistically speaking, most adults don't have a single friend of a different race.
As it happens, on the next episode of NPR's Code Switch, we're talking about making and maintaining friendships across racial lines.
Listen and subscribe.
Environmental groups are expressing alarm this week after the Trump administration announced its final plan to roll back protections for many of the country's waterways. The new regulations would make it easier for industry to dump pollution into streams and wetlands, and it would pave the way for more development, especially in the West. The Center for Biological Diversity says it would leave more than 95% of the waterways in Arizona and New Mexico unprotected. The center's government affairs director, Brett Hartle, is based in Arizona, and he joins us now. Hi, Brett.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Trump administration is calling this the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. It is a looser interpretation of the Clean Water Act from 1972 and a rollback of protections that President Obama had created. How concerned are you?
We are very concerned, and I think everyone should. The name Navigable Waters Protection Act really actually captures the heart of the problem. When Congress passed the Clean Water Act, they said that the law was designed to protect navigable waters, which they defined as the waters of the United States. And that's a pretty fuzzy term. And what's happening is that the Trump administration is taking this incredibly myopic view that the only thing that we should be protecting are navigable waters and things that directly connect to them.
Big bodies of water. So in other words, not ephemeral streams that come and go with rain or weather.
That's right. So many streams and many headwaters, so the farther up the hill you go from the river, aren't flowing most of the year, but they feed into these rivers. They provide critical pollutant trapping and sediment protection and runoff, you know, to avoid bad floods. And all of these will be no longer protected. So you can, as you said, you can pave over them. And over time, that impacts all the way down the river because all waters are really connected.
Why is this particularly harmful, in your opinion, in the western United States? Could you give me a clear example?
Sure. So the western half of the country, if you go from sort of Texas and draw a line up to North Dakota and go west of that, is considered arid. There's not a lot of rain, which means that most streams and rivers are not permanent or even sort of seasonal. In Arizona, where I'm from, rivers might only have water in them 10, 15 days a year. Some years, if it's a drought, maybe just a few or none. But that doesn't mean that there's no water. It just means that the water is moving through the ground under the surface. And all of the trees can draw from it. It's how the entire ecosystem still functions. But because it's not on the surface, the Trump administration says the Clean Water Act no longer applies.
And to lose those protections, what's the effect of it on people, on drinking water?
Yeah, so if the Clean Water Act doesn't apply, that means you can dump pollution without even having a permit. There's simply no regulation. You could fill it. You can alter that river or stream or wetland, so you can excavate it with a bulldozer. And that means more pollution in the water, more pollution in fish if you go fishing. And ultimately, it makes it harder to keep drinking water clean because there's so much more pollution in it.
Is it useful to look back at what these bodies of water were like before the protections were in place, like before the Clean Water Act of 1972? What did we see in those bodies of water?
The worldview before the Clean Water Act was that everybody had a right to pollute the water. The Clean Water Act switched that and said, you no longer have the right to pollute our water. And by basically eliminating protections for about half the nation's wetlands and many, many streams and rivers, that presumption against pollution goes away. So there's not one place where it's going to be terrible tomorrow. But just imagine if thousands and thousands of people start polluting more, what that would do downstream to water quality.
But what do you say to the argument that these Obama restrictions and the Clean Water Act went too far, that they were too much of a burden on business? Farmers and home builders would have to draw a permit every time they wanted to do something, and that it hurt the economy?
Well, the changes that Obama made followed very closely with what the Supreme Court said was the right interpretation of the Clean Water Act. And frankly, the Obama regulations were challenged immediately and never went into effect. So there's simply no factual basis to say they caused economic harm. The Clean Water Act has always allowed development. There have always been specific provisions that carve out for farmers. And it was designed to balance development with the needed mitigation and environmental protections of water. So if you had to develop or if you had to pollute, we did so in the best possible way with the least harm to people and the environment. And that still would have been the case.
Brett, why not leave this up to the states to regulate?
Because the federal government has to set the floor for what is acceptable protections. And some states do a fantastic job. California has a very strong state-level Clean Water Act that provides even stronger protections than the federal government has ever contemplated. But again, if you go next door to where I live in Arizona, Arizona has very, very limited state powers when it comes to protecting waters. So you have this strange mishmash, and water flows downstream. And it's not going to be really a lot of comfort if you're a downstream state and the upstream state is doing all sorts of terrible things, you know, in the names of making it easier for business, because you have to clean it up if you are the downstream state.
Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Brett, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, from the wetlands to the melting ice in the Arctic, as climate change has sped up that process, there are obviously environmental concerns. But there will also be impacts on trade and the military. The U.S. military is assessing what an Arctic region that's more free of sea ice will mean for its role in that part of the world. And one of the most remote communities in the country, near the western tip of Alaska's Aleutian Island chain, sees the Pentagon's interest as an opportunity. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Adak is more than 1,200 miles from Anchorage, so far that it has its own separate time zone from the rest of Alaska. That remoteness is part of why Vice Mayor Carrie Plant lives here.
I initially came to Adak on a hiking trip for the appeal of the natural beauty and the lack of bears.
Plant made more visits, then decided a few years ago to join the population of around 120 permanent residents, just about all of whom are originally from someplace else.
The key thing for me to move here was the diversity of the community and the uniqueness of it and the isolation from mainstream pop culture.
Even by Alaska standards, Adak is unique. It was massively built up during World War II as a staging ground for the American military campaign to dislodge Japanese forces from the northern Pacific. During the Cold War, the island hosted a naval air station, submarine base, and 6,000 service members and their families. There were barracks and bunkers, but also schools, a bowling alley, even a McDonald's. In the 90s, though, the Pentagon closed the Adak base, abruptly leaving behind the infrastructure for an entire town that for decades has been neglected or underutilized. Plant says visitors' first reactions are often about the stark juxtapositions.
The combination of the incredible physical beauty, people say it looks like Ireland or Scotland, combined with the urban decay of so many buildings are falling apart and there's walls missing and floors falling apart.
So I'm up on a hill overlooking the town site. It's just a very, very, very strange place. It feels like a factory town from the early 60s was just deposited on this very windy, weathery, beautiful island.
But now, residents are hoping to get a boost from the military's potential return. In September, the town hosted the first training exercises by the Navy and Marines in more than 30 years. It's part of the Pentagon's renewed interest in the Northern Pacific and Arctic, as climate change opens previously frozen waters to maritime shipping. Many people here hope the military will reestablish a permanent presence. Paul Fuse is a military liaison for the Aleut Corporation, an Alaska Native company that owns much of ADAC's land. He's working to convince the Navy of ADAC's unique appeal, including an abundance of weather-ravaged buildings to use in urban warfare training.
Because, you know, it's half fallen in, the windows are broken, it's dark, there's tunnels, hidey holes, booby traps. I mean, that's what they want.
Thousands of troops took part in the Aleutian portion of the exercise, with amphibious assault vehicles storming ADAC's beaches as helicopters helped seize an airstrip. As basketball court-sized hovercrafts carried Marines and heavy equipment across the frigid Bering Sea, wind and rain alternately pummeled the beach, and the fog seemed to advance and retreat every few minutes.
You can't simulate this.
Rear Admiral Cedric Pringle is in charge of 15,000 seamen and Marines, many of whom are in Alaska for the first time as part of these exercises.
From a Navy Marine standpoint, we looked at this exercise as an opportunity to conduct training in a very, very challenging environment.
Any changes in the military's footprint in the region are far from certain. Asked whether the Navy has plans to reestablish a permanent presence on ADAC, the spokeswoman for the Third Fleet said the specifics are pre-decisional at this point. Meanwhile, in ADAC, Vice Mayor Kerry Plant says that while no one expects the base will return to the size it was in the 90s, she's optimistic that enough military families might come back to help the once abandoned town keep transforming into a community.
I think something a lot of people in ADAC would hope for is that there's families, not just individual soldiers. Like I said, being a community and not just a work camp.
For Here and Now, I'm Zachariah Hughes reporting from ADAC, Alaska.
And Zach's story was produced by the American Homefront Project. We're continuing to monitor the spread of the coronavirus strain that has infected more than 800 people now and killed at least 26. As many as 13 cities in China have gone into some form of lockdown, with the government preventing all travel in and out from trains, airplanes, ferries, and other public transportation. But as the virus spreads beyond China, there are growing fears that it could also disrupt the global economy. Let's bring in Mike Regan for more on that. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So more than 30 million people so far are affected by this lockdown in China, which is, of course, the world's second largest economy. First of all, how much is this costing China?
You know, it's sort of too early to really quantify it, the exact impact. But what I would say is it's happening at basically the worst possible time for China. I sort of look at it as if a major blizzard hit the U.S. East Coast right over the Thanksgiving holiday, because next week is China's New Year. It's a week-long celebration,
right,
where people generally are out celebrating, spending money, you know, going to movies, going to restaurants, that sort of thing. And this is basically wiping away most of that activity. I'll give you an example. The Shanghai Disneyland is closed for the week. So it very well could be a short-term impact, but it is happening at the worst possible time. And the question really is, how long do they need to keep this quarantine type of situation going? And that's an open question right now.
Well, and there were already fears that China's economy was starting to slow down because of the trade war, among other things. But could the economic impact of whatever is involved with the coronavirus spread outside of China to the U.S. or the rest of the world?
You know, it's certainly a very real risk, and you can see it reflected in the stock market anytime there is another announcement of a case in the U.S. or elsewhere in the world. You see a notable weakness in the stock market, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a widespread epidemic, I think, in the U.S. It really depends on how much it would affect the confidence of consumers. You know, if people decide, oh, I don't want to go out to a restaurant, or I'm afraid to go to the mall because of this, it could have a noticeable impact. To be sure, we're not anywhere near that right now, but it is a risk that I think people are going to start talking about the more and more this goes on.
Well, and by the way, if the Dow Jones Industrial Average loses ground again today, it'll be the first time since August that it has dropped for four straight days. So that's interesting as we watch what's going on with the coronavirus. You know, every time there is a story like this and a lot of negative impacts, Mike, there are also some companies that can benefit from stuff like this. In this case, it's the vaccine makers. The National Institutes of Health is already trying to find a vaccine for coronavirus. Are there U.S. pharmaceutical companies that are trying to get in on that action?
They are. And you see sort of this massive gain in the stock of any company that's sort of associated with this. But I would say it's very unlikely that one of these vaccines could be on the market, say, this year in 2020, mm-hmm. just because it takes so long to test these in human trials.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, as we continue to follow the coronavirus in China, but also now in the United States, at least a couple of cases reported by the CDC. We'll keep watching. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
In Baltimore, a beloved citizen's family is growing. Later this summer, a fourth vessel that collects trash will be installed in the Baltimore Harbor. I met the inventor of the original Mr. Trash Wheel this spring to see how the floating barge scoops up junk from a river that flows into the ocean. Now, new trash wheels are coming to Newport Beach, California, and to Panama City, Panama. As the trend catches on, let's revisit my story that first aired in April. The boat ride from one side of the Jones Falls River to the other takes about 22 seconds.
Find a place to hold on.
I drive very slow.
This is not a very long trip.
It's an extremely short boat ride, but we don't want to go swimming on the way over there.
You do not. All right, all aboard. So we made it. But it's worth the journey to meet this local celebrity that floats at the mouth of the Baltimore Harbor.
I'm going to go ahead and turn it on. I'm going to do it on my cell phone.
John Kellett invented Mr. Trash Wheel, and here's how it works. Two booms extend from each side of a floating barge. Those booms extend all the way to the banks of the river. The water can flow on into the harbor, but the garbage can't. It's funneled toward a conveyor belt on the barge.
When the current brings trash down to us, it gets funneled by the booms to the conveyor. The conveyor extends underneath the water, and we have a rake system in front which helps push the trash up onto that conveyor, just like it's doing now. And you see we're getting a mix of plastic, styrofoam.
I see a Fireball whiskey bottle.
Yes, we got lots of little little whiskey bottles, and it all ends up coming to the conveyor. The conveyor then is set at an angle, and the angle lifts the trash from the river and dumps it into the dumpster, which is set on a separate floating barge.
It's all powered by a water wheel with a few solar panels for backup. And in the past few years, the trash wheels have been busy. At last count, they've gobbled up 11 million cigarette butts, 800,000 plastic bottles, and almost as many plastic bags.
We've picked up a guitar. We've picked up a kayak. We've picked up
a keg, someone's living pet python. All told, 1,100 tons of trash and debris, or the equivalent of 37 gray whales. So it begs the question, where is all of this trash coming from?
Anytime a trash can overflows or somebody throws trash out their window on the highway, it gets washed down into the storm drains, then into the smaller feeder streams, and then smaller feeder streams carry it into the Jones Falls River, which brings it down to us. And we're really the last best place to stop it before it gets spread out into the larger harbor and then on into the Chesapeake Bay. And eventually, if nothing happened to it, nobody picked it up, it would go get out into the Atlantic Ocean.
I think you're making a point that a lot of people don't realize, that I didn't realize until I came right here. We're not collecting trash that people threw into the water. We're collecting trash that was left on the streets of the city.
And that's true for all the trash that's out in the ocean that you hear about. More than 80% of it it comes from land-based sources. It doesn't come from cruise ships throwing their beer bottles over the side. It comes from cities and towns all over on the land, and that trash eventually all makes it downstream.
Now, you invented this machine a couple of years back, right?
Yes, I actually came up with the idea back in 2007 and 8.
And why? What was the light bulb that went off in your head that made you think you got to solve this problem?
Well, I worked for 20 years on the harbor, and every day I was confronted with the problem of trash in the harbor. I'd see the reaction of the visitors and the users of the harbor to that trash, and it was generally, ugh, this harbor's disgusting. So I called the city and said, we need to do something. They said, to their credit, they said, we're open to ideas.
So Mr. Trashwheel was born, and he was so popular around Baltimore that Professor Trashwheel and Captain Trashwheel are now gobbling up junk on other tributaries that flow into the harbor. Adam Lindquist runs the Waterfront Partnership's Healthy Harbor Initiative. It's the group that now oversees the project.
Now we are able to pull out dumpsters, and we actually have volunteers come out and sort through dumpsters of trash to count every styrofoam container, every plastic bottle, every cigarette butt. And it makes a huge impact, not just on the people doing it, but the photos that we take from those events and the data we collect, we share with elected officials who get angry too. They don't want to see all that styrofoam ending up in our waterways.
Lindquist says the trash wheels should get some of the credit for spurring the city's ban on styrofoam food containers last year and the state's ban this year. But there is more work to do. His group is trying to make the harbor safe for swimming and fishing.
By the year 2020.
That's next year.
That's next year. That really forced us to get creative and innovative and try new things, because the status quo wasn't going to do it.
Okay, I'm sure anybody who sees this or is listening to this can appreciate what you're doing here. Who doesn't want trash out of the rivers, out of the harbor, out of the oceans? But it's not just the trash that's causing problems in this waterway. It's the chemicals. It's years of industry. I mean, what else do you need to do to make sure that by next year you can swim in this?
Great question. So, the biggest concern after the trash is the city's aging sewer system. There is a constant leak of sewage into our waterways, and that's really the thing that makes them unsafe for people to swim in.
What was the problem? Is sewer pipes were just bursting into the water?
It's going to cost $1 billion to fix this problem, but we're kind of lucky that we found just one big problem that would address 80% of our sewer overflows. And the problem is really a pipe misalignment that's reducing the capacity of a huge sewer pipe that runs halfway across the city to the treatment plant. And so the Department of Public Works is working on that repair right now, and it will be done by the end of 2020.
When will you be swimming in this harbor?
I'm going to swim as soon as that repair is complete, so that we know there is less sewage. So I'm very tied to that repair.
But this story goes far beyond Baltimore. The inventor, John Kellett, has plans to put trash wheels in California, New York, Hawaii, Indonesia. Experts say the real way to make a difference is to catch the garbage before it ever reaches the ocean. You know what strikes me is, over the course of time, if I think about how many dumpsters are behind us that have filled up that are not in the ocean, it must really add up.
Yeah, well, I think we've taken out, this machine has taken out over 350 dumpsters in its 5 years. We're almost to its fifth birthday. And each one of those dumpsters, if we put it back in the water, we can make a mess out of this harbor real quick with just one dumpster. And when you add it up 350 times that, if you put that out there, it would just look like you could walk across the harbor for miles.
And imagine if you did this at the mouth of every river in a coastal city in America, how much trash you would pick up. The scale starts to really multiply.
Right, and not just in America. One of the things we discovered, I worked on Baltimore Harbor for 20 years, and in that time, I thought, oh, Baltimore is a particularly, you know, has a real bad problem with trash. You know, once we got rolling and building trash wheels, I realized, and we started getting calls from all over the world, and I realized Baltimore's not alone. I've been to places that make Baltimore look pristine in Brazil and Panama, Indonesia. This river is like a clean trout stream in comparison.
And yet there's a Wendy's cup on the conveyor belt that we just caught here.
Right.
So there's definitely still
If we were in Panama City, this whole conveyor would have to be going a lot faster to keep up with the amount of trash that comes down even their little rivers.
So what does that tell you? I mean, is this enough to address the crisis that is going on in the world's oceans?
Absolutely not. This is more of a treatment for the symptom of the disease than it is a cure for the disease. Everything you buy comes in a disposable package. You're not going to solve that by putting trash wheels everywhere. You have to make changes to that consumption and to that use of plastics. And there's the Wendy's cup full of water jumping in.
It just fell off the conveyor belt into the dumpster. There's little doubt that cup would have made it into the Chesapeake Bay. From there, it could have caught an ocean current on a journey around the world. But now it faces a different fate. The dumpster trash can't be recycled. Most of it's too dirty to do any good. Instead, it's on its way to an incinerator where the city burns most of its garbage. The cup will become a pile of ash and gas. And that story was part of our series on trash that first aired last April.
And the 62nd Grammy Awards are this Sunday, with big names like Lizzo, Ariana Grande, and Bon Iver up for awards. And ahead of the music industry's biggest night, we wanted to take a look at the surprising ways popular music is made in the 21st century. To find out, Andrea Shea from member station WBUR spoke with songwriters and producers who collaborated behind the scenes with one of this year's nominees, the singer known as Her.
All right. Okay. So what if...
There's a sneak peek on Her's Grammy-nominated album, I Used to Know Her, that offers a window into how one song evolved. At the end of Good to Me, we hear the musician, her name is Gabriella Wilson, teasing out lyrics with a team of songwriters and producers.
When we're together, this and that, and I feel this, and the way that you treat me is this, and it takes me back to this. Feeling is good, but are you really good to me?
One of the album's executive producers, David Arcelius Harris, was in the room. He's a professor of songwriting at Berklee College of Music in Boston and goes by the name Swag.
No one's memory is good. So we'll do these work tapes of, okay, this is the melody, or when we're working through concepts, you know, we'll have our iPhones out and recording moments. That song kind of came together organically. They were playing chords on her couch.
You got to be good to me. Please give me peace and make me believe that I'm not alone. You got to be good to me.
Swag says many of the songs on Wilson's album were crafted in Miami. That's where the 22-year-old artist assembled a tight-knit group of collaborators to live, eat, write, and record together for about a month. The musicians set up in different rooms, Swag says, and Wilson floated between them.
And if the vibe was right, either she would initiate or she would, you know, come in and be like, oh, I love the way this is going, and she would insert what was real to her.
That's how it went for a song Swag says he developed with a few artists, including producer-composer Jeff Giddy Gittleman.
It was almost like a jam session in a sense. I think I was doing some drum loops. Giddy was playing the guitar part.
So then Swag hit stop and said, you know what? Let's just improvise it. So essentially, me and the bass man Keith and Foster, We were calling out the chords to each other as the song is going. Together, it all sounded like this.
With her, their ideas became the song Lost Souls that Giddy says challenges hypocrisy, especially in Instagram and celebrity culture. Say you empower women, but don't acknowledge them. Feminism, not what you embody in. You false hope, you false positive. But eat your fruit and drink your water then. Giddy says it might surprise some people that a lot of hit songs are vast group efforts, not the work of one writer or duo at a piano.
These days, it's not uncommon to have 7 writers, 9 writers, 10 writers on a song. I believe on one of the Kanye songs, there was something like 20 or 30 writers.
Creating music, especially writing songs, is such a vulnerable thing. And the ability to know that you can be vulnerable with people you trust is huge.
That's singer and songwriter Ruby Amanfu. She and her husband Sam Ashworth contributed to HER's Best Song of the Year nominee, Hard Place. Swag did too. Amanfu says it emerged organically over dinner at her home in Nashville when Wilson brought up the concept of being between a rock and a hard place with somebody you love.
Of course, so many of us can relate to that. And gosh, like an hour later, we're like, all right, that was so cool. Wasn't expecting to write that. What if nothing ever will change? Oh, I'm caught between
your love and a hard place. Oh, Amanfu says the way Hard Place builds a new story around an old saying, to lay love there, highlights one of the biggest challenges for song crafters today.
You've got to come up with different ways of saying things, oftentimes, especially in pop music.
Working with artists from different walks of life, with different musical experiences, and the right chemistry helped HER's team do that, according to Swag.
To bring your best self to the table and share that, I think that's an art within itself. And I think that is what makes it so sacred, is having all of this diversity transform into a united thing.
HER, which is Wilson's acronym for Having Everything Revealed, won 2 Grammys last year for Best R&B Performance and Best Album. The collaborators behind I Used to Know HER will come back together at the ceremony this weekend, hoping to pick up a few more for Album, Record, and Song of the Year. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea. Wanna believe what you say, but I hate you on most days. You've been testing my faith, my patience.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.